Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. So skip replacing every carb with cauliflower and indulge in your breakfast, lunch, and dinnertime favorites while still hitting your goals. From breakfast bagels and meal-prepped enchiladas to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles, you won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.CO. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on Hero.co for more information.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Marcel Rose. Marcel empowers women to overcome binge eating, emotional eating, and eating disorders, enabling them to reclaim their lives through a unique synergy of nutritional therapy, eating psychology, and mindset coaching. She is the author of the best-selling book, The Binge Freedom Method, Your Four-Pillar Plan to Beat Emotional Eating for Good, and a BANT registered nutritionist and coach with a specialist training in eating disorders and behavioural change. Marcel works with clients across the UK and internationally, and also supports women through her free Facebook community, the Food Freedom Collective. In addition to her client work, Marcel trains other professionals in the field and regularly guests on podcasts, TV and radio. In this week's episode, we talk all about binge eating. We talk about the aspects that Marcel works on with clients, including their nutrition, their emotions, and their different hunger and satiety cues. We also speak about GLP-1s and their potential use in binge eating and why this may not be the bullet that everybody thinks could cure binge eating disorder. It is so lovely to have you on the podcast, Marcel. How are you doing today?
Lovely. Thanks for having me on.
Amazing. Amazing. I feel like we chatted quite a while ago. So it's really lovely to finally meet you and be speaking with you today.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, it was probably before the summer, I think.
This year is flying, honestly. Yeah. It's utter madness. Did you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Marcel Rose. I'm a BANT registered nutritionist and eating disorder specialist. I specialise particularly working with people who are struggling with binge eating and other kinds of disordered eating, bulimia and eating, and very much working, trying to bring in that kind of synergy of nutritional therapy with the eating psychology and the mindset coaching, and to really create something that's and help support people with a sort of compassionate approach.
I think it's so needed, and I really like the fact that you have kind of so many different pots that you dip into when you're working with people, you know, rather than just focusing on the nutrition or just focusing on the therapy side of things. I always like it when people do the whole thing, because ultimately you kind of have to work on all the different pieces to find that recovery. And I know that you do a lot of work with people that have binge eating. And I wondered maybe if you wanted to start by explaining some common traits that you see in your clients.
Yes. So obviously everyone is an individual, but we do see people really struggling with very much self-worth is on the floor. They believe that they are failing at all sorts of things because they feel so out of control around food. So often they feel very overwhelmed. They've often been on diets for most of their lives. I've got clients in their 60s and 70s who've been dieting since they're 11, 12 years old. And they feel like a failure because nothing seems to be working for them. And very often they're going into their, you know, restricting commonly, certainly in the daytime. And then that can lead to binge episodes in the evening. And binge episodes really, I think a lot of people throw around the word, I had a binge. But it might not be in the context of a sort of eating disorder, which is very much feeling completely and utterly out of control, almost trance-like. Often people describe it as, and it's eating usually a very large amount of food in a very short space of time. Though it can depend on the individual and what their perception is of a large amount of food as well. But it's most importantly, it's very distressing for them. So the distress that they feel afterwards and the guilt and the shame is huge. And then they find themselves back in the same cycle again. So the promises to themselves that they'll start again on Monday, or they'll start a new diet the next day, and they just feel very, very trapped in this kind of constant spiral of, you know, binge and then guilt, shame, possibly restriction, binge, guilt, shame, you know. So that tends to be the cycle of what we're seeing.
And I think it's such a tricky cycle, isn't it? Because I so often hear people discuss that restrictive phase, which I think often, if people don't know much about binge eating disorder, they're often quite shocked to hear that people have that restrictive phase. But I thought the whole point of binge eating disorder was that you binge and you eat too much food. But I think it's such a tricky cycle because people do go through that restrictive period, but then because they're so hungry, naturally their body is screaming out for that food. They then eat too much food in a short space of time. Then there's those feelings of guilt and shame, like you said, which then pushes them back into the restriction because it's like, oh, well, now I've eaten loads, so now I've got to restrict myself again. And it just reinforces those behaviours. And yeah. I think it's such a tricky thing to then kind of, you know, put a stop in and say, actually, we're going to break this cycle.
Yeah, yeah, because they feel like it sends them deeper into the cycle usually. And I think there's so many misconceptions surrounding binge eating, and very much often tied into weight stigma as well, because commonly, not always, but commonly people who binge eat are in bigger bodies. And, you know, there's this sort of misconception that people are greedy or lazy. And actually, this is a serious condition, a serious eating disorder that I think, sadly, from the feedback that I get from clients is that they're not taken seriously. Distress is not validated when they go to seek help from a medical professional, you know, in terms of seeing their doctor, because I think partly because it's misunderstood and partly because of the weight stigma.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting that you say that, because I spoke to a lady called Zoe Hazel a few weeks ago on the podcast, and she struggled with binge eating disorder for, I think it was 19 years. And she said, if I'd have rapidly lost weight and gone to the doctor, they would have been like, oh my God, is everything okay? You know, like, you know, what's going on? But because she'd rapidly gained weight, it was just sort of you just need to stop eating. Like, you can sort this out, you know, just have some more control. What would your response be to somebody, you know, maybe it's a client or maybe it's somebody just in society saying, well, I just need to have more control. I just need to stop eating.
Yeah. And that feels like the obvious thing to do. But actually, the way that I work with clients and what I would always say is we need to think about the body is often, even if you feel like you've been overfed or overfeeding, it's actually undernourished. And what we want to do is think about, instead of stripping things out of the diet and stopping eating, we want to actually start building and adding in. Because most of the time, with the majority of people, there's a lot of chaos going on with the eating. there's no structure, missed meals. And if we can start to actually add in, which sounds really counterintuitive to people at first when I start to talk about this, but obviously explain why and the difference it can make, then people can feel a lot less sort of all over the place in terms of the control. And it's amazing just the difference of putting in some structured meals to start with that can make a difference. And that can just give someone that little bit of motivation, that little bit of confidence in the process to think, okay, this is helping a little bit. Obviously, it's not the only reason why someone might be craving or having those binge urges. But if we can just give them that bit of sense of confidence, help regulate their blood sugars and help with the physiological area of things in a very simple, in very small steps, incidentally, as well, it has to be done slowly and in small steps so that people don't feel overwhelmed. But then they can really begin to feel a little bit more empowered.
And is that sort of the main, when you say differences, is it mostly the sort of physiological things that people see that then they think, okay, this has changed, and that gives them the motivation to go forward? Are there other changes or differences that you also see?
Yeah, I'd say initially with just sort of getting it, I say just because it's a big deal for a lot of people. It's not necessarily an easy feat at first, and I appreciate that. But even, for example, if someone never has breakfast, and people often think, well, I'm not hungry at breakfast time, so I want to delay eating for as long as possible. We add in a breakfast, and at first there could be some anxiety around doing that. And they add in breakfast, and then they begin to feel, okay, actually that feels okay. I feel quite satisfied. I'm not craving so much later on in the day. So I think on a physical level, yes, that helps reduce the cravings. Obviously, as I said, there's cravings for other reasons, but I think it helps them perhaps, you know, just mindset wise, feeling a little bit more confident and a little bit less anxious, that you can begin to see something that's different, start to break that cycle that they're constantly in.
And I think when you are in eating disorder recovery, no matter what eating disorder you're recovering from, the way that you've been eating, when you're asked to change that, it's absolutely terrifying. You know, I remember just being like, but this is the way I've done it for so long, and I've done this to keep myself safe. You know, this is the one thing I know, which wasn't keeping me safe, but, you know, in my mind, it felt like I was. And you're asking me to change that. I can understand how fearful that can be. But then actually, if you do it and you start to stick to it, you do then start to notice, I am a little bit more hungry at breakfast time. And actually, because I'm eating and I feel satiated, I'm not then eating masses later on. And my food, in reality, I might actually be eating less or eating the same at least, but it's just spread out through the day now rather than all in one go, which can bring up so many more emotions.
Yeah, and energy and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you start to see people saying, actually, I noticed that I was more energized. Often they're flagging by the end of the day with an afternoon or evening slump, and just giving them that bit of energy so they feel more satisfied. And yeah, it can really make a difference.
Yeah. And I suppose that's kind of like a nutritional perspective of it. Are there things that you work on with clients, or kind of common things that you see from maybe a more like emotional or mental perspective that sort of triggers the binge eating for your clients?
Yeah, definitely. So you can't just focus on the nutrition, because there's obviously so much more involved. So it's really about beginning to notice patterns. So we do a lot around food journaling in a very different way to how clients would probably think about it before, if they've been dieting and if they've been using dieting apps and they've been tracking calories and so forth. So it's really about understanding what's been going on, and that can be emotional, and thinking about thoughts as well, because you've still got the eating disorder thoughts that might be coming up that are often going through their brains without them being aware of it, causing damage, and without them being aware of it, they can't do anything about it. So we start to try and bring that to the surface. So making note of thoughts and labeling them as an eating disorder thought, being aware of certain emotions, trying to tap into and label. So a bit, usually I do that later down the line where they're trying to really be quite specific at labeling their emotions. And very often people really struggle with that with eating disorders, as I'm sure you know. That's something we work on as well. But it's so important that it's looked at holistically, because to just isolate the nutrition side is just one part of the puzzle. And I think you need to bring in the other aspects. But another aspect, which is also quite physical as well, physiologically, but it's tuning into your appetite. So hunger and satiety. I'd always say still stick to your three meals. But if you can just check in while you're journaling before you eat, where were you on that hunger scale? You know, how hungry were you? It starts to get used to checking into that hunger. And when you finish, where are you on hunger scale? If you're still hungry, do you need to eat more? If you feel like you're on a number 10 and you've eaten to the point of discomfort, it's about looking at it without judgment, with curiosity. That's interesting. I wonder what happened there. Perhaps it was about I was sitting watching TV, feeling really down, and I ate past fullness. So it's trying to remove the judgment out of it, but noticing what might have happened there and actually what could I do differently next time. So it's a lot of self-awareness work.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the thing that you said about understanding emotions, I always laugh so much, and I shouldn't laugh because it's just the way that my brain worked. But before I kind of learned about emotions, I genuinely just thought there was happy, sad and bored. And it wasn't even happy and sad, to be honest. It was like absolutely ecstatic, like high as a kite, or very low, like, you know, sitting on the sofa, unable to move, just like paralyzed in sadness. Or bored. And boredom was not something I could feel because it was just so grey in the middle, and there needed to be the deep sadness or ecstatic happiness. And my friend showed me an emotion wheel. It absolutely blew my mind. I was like, people feel all of these things. And she was like, not people, Hannah, you. Like, you feel all these things. You just can't recognise them and you can't put them into words. And I did a lot of work kind of tracking my emotions 4 times a day. And it was so good to realize, oh, wow, I was feeling that way. And then I felt these body sensations. And then my eating sort of was affected in that way. But I think it can be so powerful to start to notice those patterns, because then also I think that you can almost spot them before they've even happened. If you know that potentially there's a particular person in your life that could potentially be a trigger for a certain emotion, whether that is good or bad, you can almost provide yourself with coping mechanisms before you even got into that situation to make sure that you're looking after yourself.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, I love that. You know, any kind of tool like the feel wheel or the, you know, I use a feelings chart, and you're not, certainly not alone. I know a lot of my clients are quite like, wow, there's emotions. Yeah. It can be quite enlightening, but yeah, it takes time, I think, to work on that. But it's such an important part of the picture, I think, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another thing that you mentioned was the kind of structured eating and how important that is. I just got back from a festival, and obviously 5 days in a field, it's just, you know, the watch goes out the clock, basically. Like, I had no idea what time it was at any point. And at one day I looked at my watch and it was 3 o'clock and I hadn't had any lunch. And I suddenly felt really kind of shaky because my blood sugar had gone. And I said to my partner, I was like, we've not had lunch. And he was like, don't worry about it, it's fine. Like, we're at a festival. I was like, no, because if I don't, everything's then going to be tipped over. And it's, you know, it's not just kind of a, oh, I missed that meal so I can miss more meals. But physiologically as well, my body is, it still needs that structure. Do you think that that's a forever thing, or does it depend on the person?
That's a good question. I think it's a useful strategy, because I think for anyone with an eating disorder, it's something that is a lifelong journey. So it's almost like the foundation of everything. And if you've got that there, but with the caveat that we also want to bring in flexibility as well. I think one of the big things about eating disorders is that rigidity. So we want to bring flexibility, but somehow have a kind of structure. So, you know, not that you have to eat at 7 a.m., 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on the dot, but perhaps having a kind of window of when, or some kind of strategy in, like, if they're going to do something like be at a festival, be out and about, or, you know, whatever, that they've got a strategy, and that can be really helpful, having snacks with them, having something with them. But I think, yeah, I think long term, it's a useful thing to keep in their pocket and just think, I just need to be aware of this.
Yeah, I think as you start to recover, you will potentially start to become more in tune with hunger cues and satiety cues and things like that. But for a while, you might not be able to recognize them, or if you do recognize them, they might feel too overwhelming to actually kind of respond to. But I think it works both ways, because if you have your set, your example of 7 a.m., 1 p.m. and 7 p.m., well, what happens if I have my lunch at 1 p.m. but by 2 p.m. I'm hungry again? You know, I wouldn't say that that would be positive for my recovery to say, well, I've got to wait until 7 p.m. now. But equally, you know, if some days you're not recognizing that hunger until a little bit later, I think the idea of flexibility is so important. Mm. Letting yourself be flexible on both ways. Yes. I think often people are flexible in the, oh, well, I could push it back a little bit because I'm not hungry yet.
Yeah.
Not so flexible on the, oh, well, I'll have a bit more because
I'm hungry. Yes, exactly. And snacks. That's where I think the structure is so important. But as you say, once you can tune into those cues better, you can then realize, actually, yes, I am hungry 1 or 2 hours after eating, and that's okay. And I'll go and get myself a snack, rather than what might have happened before was like distress in the fact that, oh my God, why am I hungry again so quickly? What's wrong with me? What have I done wrong? Feeling guilty about it. And then having this whole kind of argument in your head around whether you should eat or you shouldn't eat, or you should just wait as long as possible. And so, yeah, it's also honouring those hunger cues that you get.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess on the conversation of hunger cues and binge eating disorder, and there is a big, in fact, I don't even think big suffices for how large it is at the moment, conversation around GLP-1s in terms of the use of them in general society, diabetes, obesity. But one thing I've been hearing a lot is their use in binge eating disorder. I wondered if for the listeners, you would maybe mind sharing why people are potentially saying that they could be useful. And then if you want to give your 2 pence on what you think about that.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's such a big story at the moment, isn't it? And just to say, I think it's something that pretty much all my clients, it's really impacting them, but not necessarily in a positive way, just the media kind of frenzy over them everywhere and the discussions over them. But the idea is that they are mimicking a satiety hormone, GLP-1. One of them, I think it's Mounjaro, that also has a mimicking chemical of GIP, another satiety hormone. And the idea is that you take this medication and it helps you to feel, it slows everything down, essentially. So it slows it all going down through your digestive system and helps you to feel full. A lot of people are saying it reduces their food noise, all that, you know, the constant cravings and talk in their head around food, which I believe is happening while you're on the medication. But the issue that I have with them, and look, I don't judge people who want to go on them, because I completely can see the draw to them. In our society that we live in, with weight stigma so prevalent, and especially with this media frenzy, it seems to have gone back to this whole kind of, particularly around the 90s, you know, when the whole idea that we need to shrink our bodies and be as thin as we possibly can. So I can see the draw of them, and I can see why many people have taken to them. But I think that the issue is that as soon as you come off these medications, what I'm hearing from people is that the food noise, as it's described, the cravings go absolutely through the roof. So it's not sorting out the root cause of the issue, but also we see the weight regain afterwards as soon as the drugs are discontinued. We see other issues as well. At the moment, we are, you know, discovering that it's affecting things like your muscle mass, and that affects your, you know, your metabolic rate as well. So bone density, things like that. And so I think people are going on them and being drawn to them without necessarily knowing the full picture, because obviously we're not told the full picture in the media really. There's lots of side effects. But I think from someone who's struggling with binge eating's perspective, you can see why that would be an appealing position to think, if I get rid of the food noise, my problems are solved. So some people might say, well, yeah, well, okay, so you just stay on them for the rest of your life. But for a lot of people, they can't tolerate side effects, so they come off.
Price.
The price, I think Mounjaro price is going up by a huge amount, and the price generally. And for some reasons, people can't go on them as well. And a lot of people do choose, because a lot of people do think, well, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't sit with me. That's what a lot of people do say to me. And understandably, because we don't know the long-term effects and the way that it impacts all sorts of our physiology, we have no idea beyond just a few, I think, 4 years in terms of studies on the dose that's used for weight loss. We don't know how it's affecting us in all many different aspects. And, you know, I think that is a concern as well. So the issue is really that it's not affecting the root of the issue. And there are things, you know, that you can do nutritionally to help, increase naturally your satiety hormones. I would always say, work on all of these things and work on your relationship with food. And that's the thing that's going to sustain you for the long term.
Yeah. And do you know, I've had so many conversations about these medications on the podcast and outside of the podcast, because naturally friends and acquaintances, they bring up in conversation because they know that I'm going to have something to say. And I'm not 100% against them. You know, I can fully recognize that there are some people in society that could benefit from them. Mm-hmm. If you've tried to change your diet, to lead a healthier lifestyle, and you have a BMI, you know, an obese BMI, and you can't get that weight down, then potentially it could be helpful. And, you know, it could be helpful for things like diabetes. But that's not really the population I'm concerned about, because hopefully those people will be getting it through the NHS. They'll be monitored. They'll be getting the appropriate dosage that the clinical trials have done. The people I'm worried about are, you know, you said that we potentially know over 4 years at a certain dosage the implications, but some people are getting them unregulated,
exactly.
Websites online, not at a BMI where they really need to be losing weight. And as you said, the implications then and the consequences that we're seeing, people have died already from these medications. And I think that, you know, I am very concerned, obviously, about people with eating disorders and all eating disorders for that matter as well, yeah. Not just people with binge eating disorder. I think that as somebody with anorexia, someone with bulimia are going to be very susceptible and vulnerable to the possibility of being able to lose more weight. But also just Joe Blogs on the street. Like, I saw a video the other day, and I'm sure it was set up and it was as a joke, and whether this is even possible, because I've seen like the little pad things that I'm sure are like placebo, but this video was jokingly sticking one of these stickers on his wife at bedtime. And then in the next day he was eating a cookie and he was like, oh, babe, do you want a cookie? And she was like, oh, no, I'm not really that hungry. And he just like giggled to himself. And, you know, I think there's a bigger picture of kind of feminism and everything like that. And I could go on forever. But it's those sorts of messages that are really, really worrying me as well, because it just feels very backwards.
It does. I completely get what you're saying about that's the thing. If you're monitored and if it's done in that way, it's a very different thing. And what I'm talking about is, as you say, is people who will do anything to lose weight, no matter what their BMI is. And they are getting hold of them. They're not properly screened, and they're easily getting hold of these medications. And I am beginning to hear more and more about also people who have a susceptibility to disordered eating and with body image issues ending up with serious full-blown anorexia and other eating disorders in serious trouble. And I don't think our NHS or anyone really, there's no known way of treating this because it's so new, really.
Yeah. And that was something I was going to say before about it, is that, well, from your point that you've just made there, there's not enough services currently to treat people with eating disorders effectively, let alone then throwing this into the mix.
Mm.
But as you said, you know, it reminds me of when vapes became a thing. And all of a sudden, a lot of my friends stopped smoking and just started vaping. And I was like, but we don't know what the implication of this is going to be. I think it just, particularly with the weight loss drugs, it really just demonstrates, as you said, that people will do anything to lose weight. And I think going back to binge eating disorder, that scares me a lot because, as you said at the start, that weight stigma and that misunderstanding about, well, you just need to control yourself, you just need to stop eating so much, then saying that these weight loss drugs could be the cure for binge eating disorder, I think it really enforces that misunderstanding that binge eating disorder is just an issue of control. And so if the food noise and the cravings are gone, you won't have binge eating disorder anymore. And maybe whilst people are on the drugs, as you said, maybe that food noise does go. But as you said, when you were talking about how you support people through binging, it's not just the food element, it's the emotional element, it's the physiological element. And I thought it was really interesting what you said about the loss of muscle mass as well, because even I was thinking, oh God, you know, if you went on Wegovy or whatever, then you'd lose your biceps. But it's not just your biceps, is it? It's all that muscle that is used in your body to beat your heart and everything like that. So there's so much misinformation and my brain is kind of exploding.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't help that we've got major celebrities endorsing. Probably one of our biggest sporting female sporting heroes. And I think that's kind of sends a message that, well, if she needs it, then what hope is there for anyone else? It's really hard. It's really tough. I think it's really tough for anyone struggling with body image, disordered eating, eating disorders in this climate at the moment. I think it's made it a lot harder.
I think as well, there was, you know, you mentioned the 90s and I think back to when I was a child getting my Go Girl magazine and, you know, it was like the Mary-Kate and Aisling on the front cover and everybody was so tiny and that was so normalised. We shifted. We moved into this area where, yes, maybe it was like curvy was the new thing and, you know, people were doing that through bum fillers, but at least there was a shift to having, you know, a bit of bounce to yourself was okay. You didn't need to be skin and bones. And I think the thing that's upset me the most is that there's so many celebrities who were engaging in that, saying, you know, let's be body positive, like we're all beautiful, blah blah blah, and now they're on the weight loss drugs. I think that it that just kind of gives off this message that, yeah, you know, I was pretending to be body positive almost until I now have access to this. But it's, as I said before, the price of it, it does mean that not everybody can have access to it. And we are just seeing like A-list celebrities have access and it's really damaging.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. And as you say before, after the, you know, following the 90s, at least you began to see a little bit more diversity in body size and more discussion on that. So it's very disappointing, really. I feel like we've taken huge steps backwards in terms of that.
Yeah. I suppose to try and end on a positive note.
Yes.
I mean, I am feeling very deflated by it, I have to admit. And I'm trying to reduce my social media time so much because even wonderful people like Em Clarkson and Alex Light that are calling out all of this.
Yeah.
Like calling out, it's then, for me anyway, it's bringing attention to it. I'm like, oh gosh, like, I can't believe this is happening.
Yes.
If somebody's listening and struggling with binge eating and, you know, thinking, like, it's the only thing I can do, I've got to use these medications, what would you say to them?
I would say if there's things that you can try that perhaps you haven't looked at. And I think, look, I just know from working with clients, they believed that they never had the self-efficacy, the belief in themselves that they could change. They never thought that they could feel freedom around food. They never believed that they would lose the food noise, that lose, you know, break free from this cycle. And it can happen. It can with the right support. And I appreciate that not everyone has access to that, but there are things you can do. I wanted to get it all down in book because I know that I can only work with a certain number of people and there aren't that many people that kind of work in the way that I work. So, you know, I wanted to try and make that available and give people that opportunity to be able to work in a completely different way. But it is absolutely possible to break free from binge eating And I've seen people do it, you know, who've been doing it for literally 60 years of their life, and they've managed to do it. So it is absolutely possible.
Absolutely. And where can people go to find your book if they're thinking, I like what this lady's saying?
Yeah, thank you. So it's pretty much on all online platforms. So Amazon and Waterstones, and yeah, I think all the major platforms you can get it. And it's called The Binge Freedom Method. And I just try to make it as kind of least overwhelming as possible, with action steps in four separate pillars that go through the, you know, the nourish, balance, think and feel, the key sort of, but to try and help empower people with the wisdom, but also to do the actions, to do the steps, so that they can actually make physical change.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I'm sure that will be so useful to people. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to me. I think I am going to take away so much from this episode, and thank you for letting me ramble on as well.
It's been absolutely
to chat to you.
And you, I could chat with you for hours.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.